St. Francis of Assisi died nearly 800 years ago, but he remains a hero to many people, and not just Christians. The man who talked to the birds is the patron saint of animal lovers. For those sickened by the glut of materialism, St. Francis was the original anti-consumerist rebel. He was a peace broker between Christians and Muslims during the bloody Fifth Crusade, and his quest for transcendence inspires spiritual seekers everywhere. In just the last few years, St. Francis has been the subject of biographies, novels, even a travelogue, to find out why he still looms so large in our imagination. Steve Paulson talked with some of these writers and went on his own mini-Franciscan pilgrimage to the hill towns of Italy.
I've always loved the stories about St. Francis, how he preached to birds and tamed the man-eating wolf of Gubbio, and I've wondered about his deeper, ineffable side, Francis the Mystic. A good place to get a sense of that Francis is the little church of San Damiano, nestled in the Umbrian hills just below the walls of Assisi. It's a peaceful retreat, away from the mobs of tourists and pilgrims up at the great basilica. 19 Franciscan friars live here, drawn by the same question that St. Francis once asked.
The question, "Lord, what shall I do with my life?" is a question of our time. Yeah, we say, "What is my future? What is happiness? What is real value in my life?" Are the same questions.
This is Louis Bosch, a Franciscan friar from Holland. We're sitting in the courtyard with birds flitting in and out of nearby shrubs after a morning rain. San Damiano figures prominently in the story of St. Francis. This is where he wrote his rapturous poem, The Canticle of Brother Sun. His spiritual partner, St. Clair, lived here for some 40 years. San Damiano is also the place, according to legend, where Jesus first spoke to Francis from a cross inside a crumbling chapel just a few yards from where we're sitting.
St. Francis was looking for a new way of life. And in the time of his conversion, he is thinking and he is praying and he is crying and he falls on his knees and asks to the Lord, "Lord, what shall I do with my life?" And the answer is coming from the cross. "St. Francis, don't you see that my house is falling down? Go and repair my church."
It's one of the many miracles we hear about Francis. Do you think those miracles really happened? Do you think Francis really heard a voice in this church here?
For me, it is not so interesting. Or he has heard the voice in the church, or he has heard the voice in himself. But I believe in miracles, yes. I believe that also in our times happen miracles. We say what is possible and what is not possible. A miracle is not possible. But I think that the world is greater than what we can understand.
The stories about Francis or Francesco are full of miracles, healing the sick and crippled, turning water into wine, receiving the stigmata. But the conversion story is itself remarkable. Francis had been a dissolute playboy before he went off in search of glory to fight for Assisi against neighboring Perugia. He was captured and locked up in prison for a year, where he nearly died. Then he turned to God, but his father, a wealthy fabric merchant, was so alarmed that he locked up his son. Francis escaped, sold his possessions, including his father's cloth, and gave the money to the church. His father was so furious that he charged his son with robbery, which precipitated a dramatic showdown in Assisi. Francis gave back the money, then stripped off all his clothes, handed them back as well, and announced that the only father he now recognized was his father in heaven.
When people saw this in the town square of Assisi on the steps with the bishop, they knew to what he was referring, St. Jerome's famous line, "Naked, I follow the naked Christ."
Donald Spoto, author of a biography of St. Francis called Reluctant Saint.
This is the beginning of a process, which for Francis takes a lifetime. What becomes remarkable over the years is that everything that had repelled him, consorting with outcasts, with the sick, with those afflicted with contagious illnesses, everything that had repelled him, he now embraced wherever he saw it.
One seminal event was the day Francis met a leper. The scene is recreated in Valerie Martin's novel, Salvation.
The leper stands in the middle of the road, perfectly still. He is dressed in a filthy garment, patched together from bits of sacking and undyed wool, which hangs loosely upon his emaciated body. He regards Francesco and the horse steadily, his head slightly turned and his chin lifted the better to see them, for his disease has eaten away half of his face and he has only one eye. Francesco does not speak. He cannot move. They face each other on the road and the sun pours down over them so that there are no shadows anywhere. Nothing to soften or dim the reality of this encounter. The leper's eye drills into Francesco. He can feel it penetrating into his brain. From childhood, he has had a horror of lepers. The stench rising from their rotting flesh, their grotesque faces, their phlegmy, guttural voices pursue him in his dreams, from which he wakes, sweating and shouting for help. He is closer now than he has ever been to one of these unfortunate beings, and the old familiar reaction of disgust and nausea rises up, nearly choking him. But he battles it down. Carefully, Francesco places his coin in the open palm. For a moment, he tries to form some simple speech, some pleasantry that will restore him to the ordinary world. But even as he struggles, he understands that this world is gone from him now, that there is no turning back. Tenderly, he takes the leper's hand. Tenderly, he brings it to his lips. At once, his mouth is flooded with an unearthly sweetness which pours over his tongue, sweet and hot, burning his throat and bringing sudden tears to his eyes.
It's believed that Francis eventually contracted leprosy after years of caring for lepers. But this was just one of his many diseases. He apparently suffered from bone tuberculosis, malaria, stomach ulcers, and trachoma, which left him blind by the end of his life. It didn't help that Francis was an extreme ascetic, says Linda Bird Franke, author of the book On the Road with Francis of Assisi.
He mixed ashes and water into his food so as to dull his earthly appetite. He slept on the ground or on a stone slab, so that he really wouldn't be that comfortable. Whenever he felt the faintest stirrings of lust, he would throw his naked body into thorn bushes or into icy streams. He really wanted to be not of this world, but of God's world.
For 20 years, Francis somehow managed to walk all across Italy, through Switzerland, into France and Spain, spreading the word of Jesus. His preaching style was revolutionary. He spoke to people in their own dialects rather than the usual church Latin, and when people saw this humble pilgrim in rags, all of 5'2" and 80 pounds, they flocked to him. In just a few years, several thousand people joined his order. This is what I find so remarkable. They wanted to be like Francis, this man whose renunciation of the material world bordered on the maniacal. And when word spread that this wandering pilgrim was passing through town, crowds of people would converge on him and even tear at his habit, hoping to touch a living saint. He was the closest thing to a medieval rock star. Today, it's hard to know what to make of this man, especially for someone like me, what you might call a lapsed Christian. I've never had much tolerance for proselytizers, and there's no doubt Francis was a religious zealot out to save souls. But he was also much harder on himself than anyone else. He didn't possess a shred of self-righteousness, and there was something else about him. All the stories describe a man who radiated joy despite constant physical pain. I suppose it's why I and so many others travel to the ancient hill town of Assisi to touch the spirit of St. Francis. Every year, several million people visit the tomb of Francis in the crypt under the great basilica in Assisi. The basilica is really made up of two churches. The vast lower church is lined with frescoes by the great early Renaissance painters. Tour groups decked out in headsets quietly swarm throughout the church, and several priests are holding mass. In the upper church, a Presbyterian choir from Colorado is giving an impromptu concert. We're surrounded by the magnificent frescoes of Giotto recounting the life or legend of Francis. One fresco shows him poised to walk through a great wall of fire to test the power of his faith. This comes from one of the most remarkable chapters in his life, his trip to Egypt in the year 1219. It's an amazing story, even if you don't buy the firewalk. Francis joined the Fifth Crusade in Egypt, hoping, as Donald Spoto says, to end the war by converting the Muslim Sultan, a nephew of the great Saladin.
Francis went, in fact, on a mission for peace, and he expected to be captured and slaughtered on the spot. Well, he was in for a great surprise. He was ushered into the presence of this sultan, who was indeed an extremely devout man, a believer in one God, highly sophisticated, and they got on and became friends.
Francis was, in fact, appalled by what he saw in the Crusaders' camp. He realized that the Christians were the real warmongers. Linda Franke.
And that was largely because of the cardinal, the Pope's representative, Cardinal Pelagius, who was really bloodthirsty and wanted nothing more than to kill all these Muslims. And then he was going to press on to Cairo and take all of Egypt by force and therefore gain entry to the Holy Land. And it was the Sultan who was sending out peace feelers all the time, because what he wanted was for the Crusaders just to pack up and leave.
Francis left Egypt an admirer of Islam. In fact, when he returned to Italy, he wanted the church bells rung 5 times a day to mirror how often the Muslims prayed to their God. A great medieval church was designed to inspire awe, and the Basilica in Assisi, with its art, its beauty, its sheer size, does that. But this grandeur was precisely what Francis despised about the church. If you really want to feel his spirit, his old hermitages are the places to go. His favorite sanctuary was the Carceri above Assisi, a few steep miles up Mount Subasio. It's a magical spot, nestled in the trees, perched high above the valley, a world away from the hordes in Assisi. A few Capuchin friars still live here. Visitors are expected to be silent, or at least very quiet, and the building itself is designed to keep you humble.
The doorway is so narrow. I have to stoop. It's maybe 4 feet tall. Well, I have to squeeze through sideways. There's a little tiny stone chapel with a picture of the Madonna and the baby Jesus. Various people have left tiny crosses just made by two twigs strung together, and they've left little prayers with stones weighing them down, saying thanks to San Francesco.
There's a taxi driver named Mauro parked outside the Carceri gate. He's brought lots of pilgrims and visitors here over the years. I asked him why people love St. Francis so much. He says it's because Francis threw his lot in with the dispossessed.
In that period in Assisi, there were two social classes. So he refused to be rich in order to be humble and simple. So I guess this is quite a step of courage, if I can say.
Now, do you find Francis, does he have any particular appeal to you, or is he just ancient history?
No. I think he's very interesting. He was a soldier. He was rich, he was strong, but he decided to be humble. So I don't have the courage to do that. I'm looking for money. So I'm curious about him.
2 years before he died, Francis experienced his greatest miracle. It happened across the valley in Tuscany on another mountaintop, Laverna. There, according to legend, he received the 5 wounds of Christ. It's the first recorded case of a person receiving the stigmata. As Linda Franke tells the story.
Suddenly, the night sky turned bright as day, and the animals stirred, and people got up and started their day. But of course, it was the middle of the night, and a light shone down on Francis standing on the edge of a cliff, and a seraph appeared in the light. And by the time the seraph left, Francis had the nails, the wounds, in his hands, exactly as Christ had on the cross, and in his feet, and the lance wound in the side. He hid those wounds. You know, he was a very humble man, and very, very few people knew about the stigmata until after he died.
What should we make of a story like this? Donald Spoto says these wounds sound suspiciously like the black marks left by leprosy. I prefer to let the miracles just wash over me. They're great stories, above all, and that's the thing about St. Francis. No matter what edicts he laid out for his followers, his greatest work was his own life. and you really can't separate his transcendent experiences from his terrible suffering. Near the end of his life, Francis suffered from an excruciating eye disease. His doctors insisted on an experimental and quite brutal treatment, cauterizing his temples with a red-hot iron.
The coals begin to crumble and the embers hiss. Francesco bends toward the brazier until he can feel the heat on his forehead. "My brother Fire," he says, "be courteous to me at this hour. I beseech our Creator, who made you, to temper your heat now so that I may be able to bear it." At these last words, he raises his eyes to the brothers huddled behind the doctor. He has calmed his own fear, but panic grips their hearts. And as the doctor lifts the first iron, one by one they slip from the room. The nauseating smell of burning flesh floods from the narrow chamber, filling their mouths and nostrils so that they clap their hands over their faces. Brother Rufino drops to his knees, then swoons flat onto the hard earth floor. In the room, the doctor lays the iron back upon the grate and turns to examine his handiwork. Francesco does not move. He has not moved, has not spoken, clenched his fist, cried out, or wept. He gazes placidly into the middle air with the vacant, listening attitude of the blind. The bright red flesh between his ear and eyebrow still sizzles, and at the edges of the wound, thin strips curl away, blackened by the heat of the iron. Carefully, the doctor bends over him and removes a few hairs from the singed brow. "Now, for the other side," he says.
It didn't work. Francis apparently was not afraid of dying. He even cried out, "Welcome, Sister Death." He was 45 when he died. There's something a friar told me that stayed with me. He said Francis thought of Jesus as his lover. It helps to explain the rapture, the ecstasy that he so clearly experienced throughout his life. And here's where I can't follow Francis. I will never feel that rapture. No matter how much I yearn for the divine, I'm rooted in the realm of earthly pleasures and more subdued reflection. That said, I'm very glad to know about the life and legend of St. Francis to remind me of that other world.
Steve Paulson produced that story about St. Francis. A special thanks to Sarah Day for her readings from Valerie Martin's novel Salvation. There's a postscript to the story. After Francis died, his followers were so worried that looters would steal his body that they hid it deep in a rock tunnel, and then they forgot where it was buried. So, for 600 years, the coffin was lost until it was discovered in the early 19th century.